the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. It's a Friday today, though. Very strange. Obviously, I'm the only one on the panel here. Repping for the CBP Media Network. Today, I have Max Gagliardi, Talk Energy, Ankova. Lots of stuff to discuss. Obviously, lots of crazy stuff when it comes to the world of energy going on right now. But before we start, as always, this show is brought to you by two great Canadian companies. The first presenting sponsor, ShakePay. Best place for you to buy Bitcoin in Canada. It's easy. It's fast. Everything is basically free. Very low spread. Ins and outs with your e-transfers are zero cost. And they got four or five things going on all the time. They got shaking sats, shake your phone every day. They funnel you a few Satoshis, which is great. If you sign up a friend and use the promo code CBP, you both get, or if you sign up and use our promo code CBP, you get $30. If you use your own promo code, you and your buddy can get $30. You can do that too if you want, but I prefer you use ours. They also have Shake Paid, where if you use your CAD balance to buy something, you can get the whole thing comped, which is great. And then they have some other stuff going on as well, the ShakePay Earn and some other programs that are in the pipeline, which is awesome. We had Carlo on, their community guy, last Monday. I am really, really excited about some of the stuff they have coming. So stay tuned for that. And then, of course, Ledit is our other sponsor. If you want to get a mortgage and use your Bitcoin as collateral, there's only one place to do it. Ledit is the place. Not available in all jurisdictions, obviously, but still not bad. Len and I both parked a little bit of our Bitcoin there. We earn a pretty good interest rate. They just changed their rates the other day. I think they're both a little higher, USDC and Bitcoin. You can't really go wrong with a company as low risk, as transparent, and as shitcoin averse as Ledin is. So give them a look. You can use our promo code. It'll be in the description of the video somewhere. Len takes care of all that stuff, so I'm sure it'll be there. And that's all we got. So let's get started. Max Gagliardi is here. I was telling him before we sat down that he's got maybe the best studio in the game. I've been on a couple shows where there's been good studios. Like, you know, BTC Sessions, obviously, I'm sure. Ben's got a really nice studio. But I think this one might be a little higher quality. Do you want to talk about that first? Like, do you think you have the best studio on YouTube, or is that just viewers of yours?
It's just in a garage. I mean, it's all lighting, man. It's all lighting. you just get like the lighting and get the right lens for a camera, and just a lot of YouTube. Like we were saying right before I got on here, it's like there are a lot more expensive setups you can get. But if you just watch like, you know, a few YouTube videos and figure out kind of the lighting, like the different lights, like, I don't know, there's different things you can do to make it look better. But I'm really just sitting in like a garage right now. If you could see like everything else, it's not that impressive. It's just you just have to make like this part impressive, like the part that you're sitting in.
The behind the scenes struggles of the podcast.
Crowd. Yeah, dude, it's actually pretty messy in here, but it looks good from like what you can see.
I got to take a picture of mine. I'll put it on Twitter after. So, Max, first of all, thank you for coming on. I know we tried to book this for Wednesday. We had some scheduling stuff, so I appreciate you making time on a Friday. Now, a lot of people know who you are, but I suspect a lot of our listeners also do not. So tell people a bit about you before we get started.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's fun to do these. I like being interviewed sometimes because I do so many interviews on the, I have the Talk Energy podcast for people that don't know, and started that about 18 months to 2 years ago. It was kind of like at the beginning of 21. And my background's in oil and natural gas. Like, I worked for Chesapeake Energy out of school, which, if, for people that don't know, they were like the largest driller of natural gas and the second largest, I believe, producer of natural gas in the US. And my role has always kind of been in like what we call the commercial role. So basically, like, selling the product is the easiest way to describe it. So you got the energy, you create it, you drill for it, and then you have to build infrastructure. And then the infrastructure has costs involved, obviously, similar to like Bitcoin mining. And then you move that energy to a market and you sell that energy. And it's just kind of this niche part of the oil and gas industry. And so for pipelines, it's like, or for gas, it's pipelines. You're moving it in on a pipeline. For oil, a lot of times it's trucking. Sometimes it can be pipelines. And so it's just this niche that I got lucky to kind of fall into and really enjoyed it. I mean, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And that was something that was interesting. It's like kind of technical, but also there's like a business aspect to it. You can negotiate, and there's a people element, I guess. And so did that. And then in 2014, followed the CEO of Chesapeake, left and started a new company. And I went over there and followed him for about 7 months. And then that was like a long story. Like, there's a huge bear market. And the price of oil went from like $85, $90 to like $30 basically. And so the industry kind of fell out. And so left that company and didn't know what I wanted to do, and partnered with my old vice president from Chesapeake, who is 30 years my senior. And we were both kind of like consulting. We thought maybe this is just like a temporary thing we were going to do. It's turned out that we picked up a couple clients, and then that turned into like half dozen clients, and then like a dozen clients. And basically we were doing exactly what we did for like a big company, but we did it for like lots of small and like mid-sized companies because they just didn't have the people, like the skill set that we had. And so kind of snowballed forward, and we hired people, and that was Ancova Energy is the name of that company. And we also buy and sell product as well. So we'll physically buy natural gas and resell it and kind of act like as a broker and charge a fee on that. And we had a pipeline business that we did for a while, and then COVID hit and that kind of stopped. And during COVID was when came across Bitcoin, like knew about Bitcoin, hadn't really been that involved with it. Everybody has a story. I had like a brother-in-law who had been in Bitcoin for a long time and was telling me like, you need to buy Bitcoin, and just telling me all the stuff about it. And of course, it's one of those things where you had some money sitting aside. You're like, yeah, I'm going to buy like a couple Bitcoin. And then you just like never got around to doing it. And then just kind of like watch it go up for all these years. And you're like, oh my God, like, so they're like, should have done that. And so I had this brother-in-law that had always been telling me about it. And he'd been stacking for all these years. And so I kind of knew about it. And then what really got interesting is when I started to see the energy aspect of it in the mining, and had the podcast, and I started having guests reach out that were like, hey, you were talking about Bitcoin mining, and just went down the rabbit hole. And it was like late 2020, early 21 is when I started really getting into it pretty heavily. And the whole thing was like, look, if I'm going to do this from a business standpoint, like I have to understand Bitcoin. I was like, I get that it uses energy. I get that it kind of like my skill set of like building infrastructure and, you know, monetizing energy could do well for this. But I was like, I can't devote time to that aspect of it unless I understand Bitcoin. And I'm just one of these people that like when I get into something, I just go completely into it. And so, you know, read like all the books you could read and all the podcasts and all the stuff. And so just went full Bitcoin for the last couple of years. It's been almost basically two years now. And so we're doing some consulting for some miners where we're kind of helping them source natural gas and, you know, tie them into either stranded or disadvantaged gas to mine for themselves. And that was during a time when natural gas prices were really low. So it was like pretty good sell. I mean, Bitcoin prices were pumping, natural gas prices were dumping, and it made a lot of sense to basically, you know, go and match those two up. And then we did that for a while, and we thought, you know, this is something we want to do ourselves. So we started Ancova Digital, not a very creative name, but we just used the existing brand and then did that. And we have like a couple sites that we've done. We've got, you know, what we've done is we went out and bought interest in oil and gas wells. So we're not really using stranded natural gas. We're using natural gas that does have a market. And so the thesis was like, buy the reserves, buy the energy up front, and then sell some to the market to like cover our costs and cover our operating costs, and then mine Bitcoin with the rest. And that's what we've been doing on that front. And it's like relatively small, but big for us because we didn't go out and like raise a bunch of capital. We just did it kind of with our own capital. And so it's not the hugest deployment, but it's for us, it's meaningful. We're trying to deploy more hash now. We've got, you know, we've made our own containers. We bought one container initially from a third party, made our second data center, and we're now constructing our third data center. It looks really good. It's like looking a lot better than the other ones that we did, and we're trying to find a home for that. So it's still relatively fledgling, but yeah, man, that's kind of the story. Sort of long-winded there, sorry, but that's how I got to today.
That's a very good, I was going to ask you that question anyway, Max. It's a, you know, good that you were able to get it all out in one shot. There's a lot of stuff I want to unpack there. I think maybe first let's talk a bit about the podcast Talk Energy. As you mentioned there, you're very good with names. So we got Ancova, Ancova Digital, and then Talk Energy Podcast. Now, I can't really say much about names because we got the CBP media thing in the corner here. All I did was take the first three letters of the show and add media to the end. So these things are difficult, right? We can't be good at everything. But what I'm finding on your program, and there are others as well, traditional macro shows, for example, where there's more and more Bitcoiners making appearances in other disciplines, whether it's energy or macro or, you know, geopolitics or whatever. I've been listening to your show for a while, and one of the things I find is that almost every episode you either defend, I think you either find yourself defending Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining, or it feels like to me anyway, you're very close to doing it and then you decide not to. Do you think that there's a general, I don't want to say distaste, but skepticism, hesitancy in the energy industry still, given that you have some eyes on that from where you are with Ancova when it comes to Bitcoin? Or do you think that they're starting to become maybe not warm to it, but it's at least on their minds, let's say?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think in the, you know, during that time when natural gas was really low pricing wise and Bitcoin was pumping, there was a ton of interest in from oil and gas producers, you know, mainly guys that had stuff that was stranded, but not just that, just people that wanted to say, hey, look, this is like viewing it as a different market for their energy. So they're very open to it. We've seen that interest kind of die down as oil was like, you know, now it's pulled back a little bit and gas has pulled back a little bit. But there for a while, we were like over $100 oil and nat gas was at like 10, 12 year highs in terms of price. It really just ripped. And so, you know, guys that were like, hey, how can I take a $2 an MCF gas stream that if you convert it to Bitcoin would be like $30 an MCF. That's a huge arb. And they were like, we got to figure out how to do this, to the point where then Bitcoin collapsed in price. And it's actually still more, if you have the newest gen ASICs, it's still a better deal. And especially with gas pulling back, it's still better to mine for Bitcoin. But guys' focus, I think, got drawn away to going out and just doing like traditional oil and gas stuff, like drilling wells and just trying to optimize their existing production. Now that's the real world, and the world of like business. On the Twitter world, there's very much, which is sometimes the real world, sometimes it's not, is these, you know, definitely like battle lines drawn between different, like everything is like your cult, right? It's like, what do you, you're like a hard asset bro. You're like an oil bro. You're like a Bitcoin guy. You're like a whatever real estate person. You're a, whatever you may be. And like, I have different things that like, I kind of, you know, we have different ventures that we've done. So I sort of like straddle a number of different things. And what you'll find is that it can be like really polarizing. Like when you had like the talk energy thing and you're talking about oil and gas stuff, and then you have like a bunch of Bitcoin episodes, it's just like ruthless people like attacking you. Cause like what I think about like with your channel and where you guys are focused in a lot of these Bitcoin channels is like, you're pulling people into your distribution that are like specifically here for Bitcoin. If you're pulling people in that are like, oh, I saw this episode about like nuclear energy or about whatever, you know, coal or just something random. And then like I do an episode about Bitcoin mining or, you know, something Bitcoin related. You just get all these people like coming at you being like, this guy's like a scammer. This guy's like Ponzi guy, you know, because you didn't pull those people into that distribution channel because of Bitcoin. You pulled them in because of something else. So I will say that like there are times that I'm defending it. Most of the times on my podcast, it's not really that confrontational. It's not like a gotcha show where I'm like getting people on and getting in arguments. So most of the stuff is like trying to find middle ground. But I definitely think that most people are curious, but there are some people that are hostile, I think, and still are just like, don't see the value in it. Don't see the, you know, any of the stuff that we obviously see. And so you're trying to educate, but at the same time on Twitter, it can get like semi-hostile.
I am like so close to only posting memes on Twitter and not posting any text. Memes and workout thirst traps, I think, is going to be my niche. Maybe I'll think about that over the winter. You and I have shared one guest in particular in the last little while that I think is he and his team probably the smartest guys in the commodity space as far as retail access. That's Thunberg. Yeah. And we brought him on to talk to us about the bear case for Bitcoin. He was our first guest that we brought on specifically to tell us why he thinks Bitcoin's not going to work. I thought it was a good episode. To your point, we got a lot of flack for that. But, you know, I think that your approach and the approach we try to take as well is there's middle ground to be found. Let's find it in a medium where everyone can make their own decisions. I like to think that the people that come into a distribution channel like yours or mine are at least a little bit of the way there when it comes to what they expect from a discussion on the internet, where there's, you know, a little bit of latency, people are having a beer, they're in their garage, they're, you know, there for a good conversation. They're not there to get spun up and upset. Let's talk a bit though about some of the things that Thunberg and others have to say about Bitcoin as it relates to energy. And then we'll get into some energy stuff that's going on today. You're in a position, Max, and Ancova's in a position with their exposure to mining and your exposure to Bitcoin mining, where you can see the synergies between energy and Bitcoin. They're all over the place. I think a lot of Bitcoiners understand them, or at least on a surface level understand them. And I think a lot of the energy guys understand them. Exxon, for example, is doing some kind of pilot stuff somewhere in the United States at the moment when it comes to Bitcoin mining. What do you think is holding other energy companies back? It seems to me that Doomberg and others' view is that Bitcoin is just never going to be this thing that makes sense, because energy companies, this is only partial, of course, but energy companies ultimately have to have at least some kind of nod to the ESG fanatics. And this doesn't really help their cause. You know, Bitcoin is not an ESG friendly asset class at the moment. Do you have a view on what is holding major players back from embracing Bitcoin? I mean, price is obviously one thing, but apart from price, are there others?
So a couple of things. One thing is, I think Doomberg's views are not totally unreasonable. I mean, I think if I could boil it down, because we did an episode, kind of, I think we call it the Bitcoin debate, which is really kind of cheeky.
Which I recommend people watch. It was an excellent episode. People should definitely tune into that on Talk Energy.
And he hit me up on that. He was like getting a bunch of hostile stuff coming at him for his criticisms of not just Bitcoin, but like crypto in general, which a lot of the stuff he writes about crypto, I agree with, because I think there are a lot of issues. But you know, the thing that I think it boils down to, a couple things that he argues, and he basically argues that like money is government and government is violence. So money is violence. And so it's like basically like this is the most powerful tool they have, which is money, and the government effectively is violence. And so if you think that like you can just exit the system, like you can't, because they have a monopoly on violence, and violence is something that at the end of the day, like if you saw it with the Canadian trucker thing, it's like if they want to shut you down, they can shut off all the on and off ramps. They can, you know, so he gets into these arguments about, you know, it's not a circular thing. Like you have to cash it out into fiat. He also argues, he's like a Tether truther, which I don't know. I actually don't know that much about stable coins. I think that it's a capitalistic market, and we've seen some of the stable coins that have gone bust. And if Tether is a scam, then someday it may go bust. But obviously they're doing something right, because it's using, lots of people are using it. But these are some of the arguments that he kind of tries to make, and some validity to these. I mean, at the end of the day, like if the government wants to do things, a lot of times they have a lot of power. And I think Bitcoin has a lot of resistance to that. I try to counter in a friendly and conversational way, try to counter many of his points in that episode. But I think that like the traditional energy industry, the challenge is going to be that most of the if you look at like the big companies that are like the super majors, like an Exxon or a Shell or a BP or Chevron, most of the old Standard Oil companies that got broke up, if you don't know the history of those, but they are large bureaucratic, just these giant companies. The way that you get to the top in these companies is not to innovate. It's the opposite of innovation. Like if you want to make it to the top of an Exxon or one of these companies, you almost should never innovate, because that's not what they want. They number you, they put you in a system, and you play the game, and it's politics, and it's, you know, you have to have like an engineering degree, and you have a certain number, and then you make it up to this ladder, and then this ring. And so these guys aren't paid to think outside the box. They're paid to run a manufacturing business, basically. And there are some creative types in energy, you know, geologists, people that do exploration and find these resources in the ground. I'm not saying that everybody there is just like a corporate stooge. I'm not trying to be too mean. There are some creativity and innovation in these organizations, but for the most part, they're running a manufacturing business, manufacturing a resource. And so I think that to get these people to break from the norms and to step outside their comfort zone from what they're doing is difficult to do. And so I just think that there's like a natural resistance. A lot of the people in the oil and gas industry are very analytical, very I guess that's left brain, right? The side that's like analytical or whatever, or is that right brain? Can't remember.
I don't know. I've seen a graphic or two probably, but I don't know which one it is.
One of the other ones, whichever one it is, the side that where you're not, you know, you're more kind of numbers focused, engineering, science type of stuff. And so I just think that the cultural aspect of it is difficult for people. That being said, I think at the smaller company level, at the entrepreneurial level, there is a ton of entrepreneurs. People think of big oil as like these big companies, but in the US in particular, we have personal property rights for minerals, which is very unique for a country. Most countries, the state owns the resources in the ground. And so in the US, like private individuals, families, companies can, and also the state owns a lot too. The federal government owns a lot of minerals as well, but private individuals can own these minerals. And then therefore private companies can do deals with, you know, someone, for example, a family that owns minerals, and they say, hey, I want to drill on this land. They can get a lease on that land. And so what this does is that fosters a lot of startups. It fosters a lot of innovation and a lot of entrepreneurship. And where I am seeing Bitcoin being embraced and being explored and Bitcoin mining is taking place is kind of at the smaller company level. And you see that a lot in the industry. A lot of times these trends will start something, you know, will start with like a smaller company or a mid-size independent. And then it takes like the bigger guys, you know, some time before they come around and they realize, hey, these people are doing this and they're making money. So I don't know when it will be mainstream, but I do think that it is happening. And we talk to people all the time that are interested in it. And I think when the price pumps again, right now, it's like the best time to be Bitcoin mining because the computers are so cheap and your cost basis is so cheap. It is getting a little scary coming up against the halving. But outside of that, it is, it's a great time to do it. Yet with the price down, it's like anything else, right? Like people aren't as interested in it now because of, when it was like 60,000, everybody wants to do it. And then when like, it's a really good entry point, people aren't talking about it as much. So that's kind of, my views on some of the Doomberg stuff and then the traditional industry stuff.
It's very strange, isn't it? That it seems like no one is paying attention to all these cycles and the way that Bitcoin behaves through the years. It's really, you know, I don't want to say predictable. That's the wrong word. Past performance is never, you know, a predictor of future success. But there's not too many relationships with past performance like Bitcoin has. Anyway, so let's talk a bit about your bread and butter. Okay, we're going to talk oil. We're going to talk natural gas. We're going to talk energy, United States specifically. Although we are a Canadian-focused show, Max, okay, we find ourselves talking all the time about energy policy abroad, both in America, Europe, and we cannot figure out what the front door is going on in these major superpower nations that they just refuse to drill, frack, retrofit nuclear plants, keep plants open. Here in Ontario in Canada, we're one of the major exceptions to the rule. We seem to continue to, you know, run our nuclear facilities almost against all odds, given the environment overseas and also with you guys next door. What are you seeing as far as the discussions oil and gas companies are having when it comes to, you know, new investment in wells or other exploration? Because it seems to me that we're on the cusp now of a period where you've had very low investment in oil and gas over the last probably 5 years, maybe a little longer, and the demand for energy only increasing. I mean, regardless of the Russia thing, populations are increasing, the third world right. is becoming developed world and all these sorts of things. What are you hearing from oil companies? How do they view their role, you know, kind of short and medium term, and potentially also like, you know, at Encova, how do you view your role short and medium term? What are you guys thinking about in the sort of, you know, the current scheme of things?
All right, just a lot to unpack. So first part you talked about was the international stuff and just the global energy macro. And it's really easy to fall into like these soundbite answers like, oh, it's ESG, that's the problem. And like, yes, ESG has caused a lot of mismanagement of energy resources. But there's a lot of other stuff there as well. You also touched on the lack of exploration in finding new reserves. This is a huge deal. You know, back in 2014, the price of oil collapsed and the price of natural gas had already kind of collapsed, and it got pretty anemic for like a long time. Just this recent run up was the first time that we'd seen those prices since like the late 2000s. So what happened was we innovated in the oil and gas industries, particularly and specifically in America, and with the shale revolution, which was for people that don't know, basically a bunch of rock that was just thought to be unrecoverable. So you hear all these rumors like peak oil, like we're going to run out of supply, we're going to run out of natural gas. And what happens is you run out of it until the price gets to a certain point, and then people start to innovate. And especially in places where there's personal property rights and freedom and capitalism, it allows for a lot more innovation. And so what happens is in the US, we innovated, and it was in the form of horizontal drilling, which really got good. So that's basically, instead of drilling straight down to find oil into a reservoir, you can drill down and then out for like multiple miles. Now it's got to the point where you could drill down multiple miles and out multiple miles. It's pretty incredible what they can do. And then they coupled that with new completion techniques, which is referred to a lot of times as fracking. It's hydraulic fracturing, which has been around forever. The only reason it started to turn into this political thing is because we got so good at it, and they tried to make it seem like it was this new thing that was polluting when it had been around forever and is totally safe. But they combined those two technologies, and it just unleashed this just massive amount of oil and gas that we didn't know. And never in history has anyone ever ramped up their oil and gas production as quickly and brought on as much total energy as we brought on in such a short period of time. And what that did was that number one was incredibly deflationary. I mean, just deflationary. People don't understand. It saved consumers, not just in America, but around the world, trillions and trillions of dollars by lowering their energy costs. So personal property rights, freedom, capitalism, and innovation combined to basically create this just wave of deflation. And that's why I think in a lot of ways, tying this into more of the macro stuff, was the reason why some of these Fed policies, keeping interest rates so low, you know, doing these things where we can just, you know, print money and all this stuff was happening. Like, that's really easy when the base input, the master resource, is seemingly unlimited during this time period, because that's the basic input to virtually everything. It was dirt cheap. And so we unleashed this huge resource, and then, you know, supply and demand kicked in. As we know, you got a ton of supply that comes online. And what does that do? That causes the price to crash. So the price crashed. It was really low. And it kind of became this negative feedback loop where we had these really low prices. Guys had to go because we basically were our own worst enemy. Like, we got so good at doing what we could do that it crashed the entire world's oil and gas markets. It really hurt countries like Russia and OPEC and a lot of these people. And that's why they did the thing in 2019 where they are going into COVID, where Russia started and OPEC Plus started cutting production to try to started pumping production to try to squeeze us even more, because they knew that we were hurting because the prices were so low. And so basically that time in 2014, when the prices got really low and we had the crash, a lot of the exploration stopped. And so what that means is that we quit spending money on what normally people would consider like R&D, like research and development. Like in other industries, in the oil and gas industry, we call that exploration, and going out and finding new fields, finding new reserves. And those dollars are some of the first dollars to get cut. Like, when things get really bad and you're in a bear market, you just focus on drilling your best well next. Like, every next well needs to be your best well. And everybody cuts costs and they cut exploration budgets and things like that. And so for a, you know, better part of a decade, around 8 years, 7-8 years, we just weren't going out and finding new oil and gas. We were basically harvesting all the oil and gas that we had unlocked through this innovation, and it was keeping the price very much suppressed. And then, you know, prices started creeping up a little bit, and there'd be periods where it'd get to like $60-$70 and it would kind of crash again. And that all led up to COVID. So when COVID hit, we had this huge shock where, you know, the world shut down, demand plummeted. And the thing about oil and gas is that demand and supply is fairly inelastic. So, like, you're always kind of like producing just enough. Like, energy is one of those things. It's kind of this amazing balance. And it's the same way with the grid, is where we're like almost in total harmony all the time, where we're just producing enough that the consumers need. There is some storage. You can store oil, you can store gas in the ground, electricity, you're generating power, you're doing it. It's kind of this balance that people don't realize. And so so it just takes a little bit of demand destruction to cause kind of wild swings in the price. And so when COVID hit, we had oil prices go negative. I joke with Bitcoiners, it's like, yeah, you guys think this is volatile. It's like, we're in an industry where like the prices went negative. You know how scary that was? It was scary. Like, I remember, it was like one of those moments where you remember where you're at and you're like, this, what is happening? To see like the price.
Do you want to tell people exactly the mechanism? I think a lot of people look at that moment in time and they know it went negative, but they don't know why. So if you got like a 30-second thing, tell people, because I don't think a lot of people understand.
Basically, like the price that you see on the screen is like a futures price. And so a lot of times for a futures price, you can settle it. There's financials and there's physical. And so sometimes you have to settle it physically. So like if you say that like I'm going to have this many barrels on this futures contract, to close out that contract, a lot of times you have to actually physically have access to those barrels, and you can do it at like a trading hub. And what happened was a lot of people couldn't actually get rid of there was just not enough places to store the oil. People had entered into these contracts and there was no way to settle these physically, to the point to where basically it just kept getting bid down to where people were having to essentially pay to get out of these financial instruments. It's like this like layman's simple way to describe it. So effectively, like, and a bunch of people got just like murdered on this deal. Like, I don't know, there's like stories of like, you know, amateur traders that made like some trade, you know, just like some guy in his house, and ended up owing like millions of dollars because they saw oil at like $1 and they're like, I can't go negative, so I'm just going to leverage this, you know, and then like goes to negative $37 and they get margin called for like $5 million on like a tiny trade or something. So it is a really wild time. And I'm not like really a derivatives guy. So like I'm not really in that. We're more in the physical world with the product that we sell. But even on the physical side, it started backing up. Like there was storage that was full. You couldn't move barrels. Crazy stories about people like trying to put oil in like swimming pools, you know, to arb it and be like, I'm going to buy it at like a dollar and then resell it when it goes back up. I don't know if that ever happened, but there was people doing all kinds of harebrained schemes to find storage. But so that happened in COVID, and it was basically caused the entire industry to seize up. Hardly any new drilling. Drilling dropped to like the lowest it had been in forever. Infrastructure investment dropped. And, you know, the thing about oil and gas in these projects is a lot of them are long lead time. Like in 2014, when things got cut, we saw a lot of the mega projects get mothballed, and like these big offshore deals, you know, these huge projects, a lot of them got delayed. You didn't see as much of that. And then the shale stuff in the U.S. can ramp up a little faster, but there's still a relatively long lead time. Like it takes time. It takes, you know, to drill a well, it takes months or a year to get the infrastructure in place. And so I'm kind of going long-winded on this, but basically it put the world in a situation where we're net short the energy that we needed as things ramp back up. And then you had the Europeans who tied themselves to Russia with all the natural gas stuff, which was kind of like a misguided way that they thought that they could like, you know, get them tied in economically with Putin to where, you know, he would be dependent on them because that's where he's getting his money from. Yet actually they were dependent on him because they needed their energy. And he launched into the Ukraine war, which is causing all kinds of problems. And then the last thing, which is kind of the elephant in the room, is the ESG stuff and just tons of misinformation in the energy industry. A lot of people thinking that we can run the world on technologies that really are just meant to be kind of supplemental. You know, renewables, I'm not saying there's never a time and a place for those, but for the most part, they are not a primary energy source. They're not dispatchable. We don't have storage solutions for them. They're intermittent. And then we're shutting down a lot of nuclear facilities because of things like Fukushima, where no one really died. And so there was all those market dynamics I talked about with lack of exploration and the prices whipsawing and all the things with COVID, coupled with a lot of policy errors around energy. And it's put us in the situation that we're in today, which is basically an energy crisis. And the last part, Ancova, I mean, we're just along for the ride, man. I'm trying to survive. I've been in it for 8 years with our own company, and we've had good times and bad times. This year was pretty good. It's hard. I mean, you know, anytime it's like Bitcoin mining and you're in an industry where prices can swing radically up and down, it's just something you got to know where you're at on the ride, you know, and just know when you're at the top and know when you're at the bottom and plan accordingly.
First of all, you never have to apologize for rolling downhill on the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. Okay. We encourage all guests to roll downhill. It makes my job easy. I only brought one beer. I should have brought a second one because I'm barely talking. This is fantastic.
So, I can go, man. I can go. That's what I just figured.
Max, you're a passionate guy. That's one of the reasons we brought you on, because I can hear it on your show. You're always like on the cusp of lighting somebody up and you never do it. So I'm interested in you going in here. So let's talk a bit about some of the stuff you mentioned there. Great information. There's an appetite for exploration at the moment. No doubt about this, right? From a pure demand standpoint for energy, there is an appetite for exploration. Yet, there is very little exploration. What, in your view, is the hang-up in that regard in America and maybe in Europe as well, if you know? And second part of that question, do oil and gas companies have, because this is another Twitter talking point, oil and gas companies don't have the faith in modern governments to allow for real capital investment in wells and exploration and drilling, all these different things, because they don't know year to year what the whims of the median voter are going to allow for them to do long term. So if you could talk a bit about those things, I'd be very interested in hearing your views.
I mean, exploration, this is something that really is more tied in, I think, to the ESG stuff than you would maybe think at first glance. So investors came in, institutional investors, they're getting a lot of pressure on particularly public companies to, you know, basically a lot of these, you hear about all these like pension plans and stuff like Harvard and Princeton and people divesting of all fossil fuels. Okay, fine. That puts stress on their market caps. I've said in the past, if they can't get it from investors, they'll get it from consumers. That's not how that works, guys. Like, right, Harvard, you know, people, you don't want to give oil and gas companies money. You don't want to invest in them, make their stock price higher. That'll cause them to have a less of a market cap. It hurts their capital structure, and then they will produce less. And then the price of the commodity will go up and consumers will suffer. So much for the S on the ESG. You know, it's basically just a tax on poor people. when they do that. So there's a lot of pressure from institutionals to divest of this stuff. You're still seeing that, although people like Jamie Dimon, who has a lot of bad takes, he has had a good take on the whole, like, this would be hell if we did this strategy for Americans. And he's right. It would be hell for, you know, mostly the poor people. It would hurt the most because, you know, anytime you do anything to restrict energy, whether that be in adding intermittency to the grid via renewables, whether that be taking capital away from fossil fuels, this is all just a regressive tax. It's a fancy regressive tax. It makes people feel good, but you're just hurting the poorest people because rich people, they don't care. They're going to put $200 to fill up their Escalade. Like, it doesn't bother them. They're rich. It's the people that are trying to get by, and the poorest people and the middle class people, they're going to be hurt from these policies. And it's happening this year with inflation, and energy is a big piece of that. In terms of just the exploration part of it, there's also this aspect of, and part of this, I'm be fair when I give this narrative, is that oil and gas companies, because they were so successful, we were our own victims of our own success in terms of we crashed the price. So the returns like weren't good. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Like, a lot of guys went bankrupt. A lot of guys, the returns weren't good. Think of it in like Bitcoin mining terms, where you got like too much hash rate coming on and guys like levering up to put the hash rate on, and then they go BK, like this Compute North or whatever they were called, that just filed the bankruptcy. That's like, I mean, Bitcoin mining and oil and gas is very similar. A lot of guys got levered up to the hilt, and then they drilled too much. It crashed the price. So think of it like the hash price. Like, it got ridiculous, even though it didn't justify them drilling that much, but they did it because they had debt to service. And so investors were pissed. And you can blame it all on ESG, but it's not just ESG. There was a lack of capital discipline. The other thing about oil and gas companies is they're kind of like gamblers. I mean, like, a lot of the guys, like wildcatters is a term, and it attracts people that are risk takers, guys that want to roll the dice. They want to poke a hole in the ground, and they're either going to make nothing or they're going to become fabulously rich. So it's got like this sort of like wildcatter mentality in oil and gas. And a lot of guys just drilled themselves into oblivion and were drilling, even though it didn't probably make sense because of other reasons. So the financial community came to them, and just, like, for the last couple of years, they were like, you have to be capital disciplined. You have to spend less money. You have to drill within cash flow. We have to pay down debt. And so there was just a lot of pressure on the industry, coupled with the ESG stuff, to just do better from a financial standpoint. And exploration is an expense that is viewed as something that is not core to, you know, look, if you go spend $100 million on seismic, which is where they, like, you know, take pictures underground, or buying leases in an area that's not been proven, these are riskier perceived activities. And during the boom times in the shale industry, like at Chesapeake, the company I was at, like, he was like, Aubrey was just out buying, like, you know, millions of acres of leases and being like, some of this is going to work, and spending a lot of money. And that time is kind of over. So you can blame it all on ESG, but I think that from an exploration standpoint, it's also been hurt by the industry's track record. And now investors in the public markets, and even in the private side, they're just not wanting to spend money on going out and finding more, because that's kind of like this ancillary expense. And that's going to catch up. And what will happen is eventually prices will get to a level, and they were earlier this year. They've kind of come down now, which is artificial because of the SPR releases, which is the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And they're just releasing oil into the market, which is suppressing the price. But if prices stayed high and we had $150 oil and, you know, $7, $8, $9 natural gas, guys would have enough budget to then say, okay, I've paid off my debt. I've returned money to shareholders in the form of dividends. I have excess cash. Let's go spend it on exploration. And so the cure for high prices is high prices. You need to go find more. And I think that in the US, that's been the issue. Worldwide, it's just some of these countries are just dumb. Like, the banning of fracking in, not that they have as good of resources as we do, but like in Europe, they've banned fracking in most of these countries. The UK is now saying they're not going to ban it. You know, just relying on, you know, like Doomberg would say, like, if you had to craft a strategy, if our enemies had to craft a strategy for us to use, it would be the strategy that they did, which is rely completely on Russia and OPEC. And then even renewables, it's all China. So it's basically like, you know, oh, we're going to go do this green energy. You're essentially saying we're going to outsource our energy to China, just like we've outsourced our energy to these other countries. So that's kind of the thoughts on the exploration side.
Can you talk to me a bit about the exporting, the ESG, not ESG, the renewables, I should say, stuff to China? Because I think a lot of people don't really understand, you know, there's this magic to things appearing in people's lives. There's a new wind turbine farm not far from where I am here in Hamilton, Ontario. There's a new iPhone, there's a new computer, there's a new desk, a chair, a car, whatever. I don't think a lot of people understand that we don't really manufacture anything here in North America. Do you want to explain to people what you mean when you say we've outsourced our renewable capacity to China?
Yeah. So just like in the US, so renewables are heavy industry, right? Like all that renewables are doing is that they're front loading all the carbon, right? And it's just a complete LARP. It's basically like, look, we're going to, you know, burn all these fossil fuels, mine all this rare, you know, not necessarily just rare earth, but lithium for batteries. And you've got lots of steel. I mean, if you look at a windmill, it's all made with hydrocarbons, solar panels. You've got, they burn coal in China and they make the materials to put the solar panels together. It's all done with like this heavy industry. So renewables, effectively what you're doing is you're taking all that carbon footprint and you're loading it up front. And you're doing it all at once via the form of mining and all these heavy industry that you have to do. Well, in the US and in Canada, there's things like, you know, in Canada, like cap and trade. I mean, they've made it very difficult. Like in the US, it's like the coal industry is trying to get killed. Like it's very hard to open up new mines, not just for coal, but for mining anything. And so basically what we've done is we've made it prohibitively expensive and in some cases borderline. I mean, it's effectively illegal to open up a new mine in the US. Like you could do it, but the permitting process would be a decade or more and nobody would do it because you would get blocked by environmental lawsuits. And so all these things, this is the irony of it, right? Renewables are so dirty to make, it's illegal to even make them here. That's how dirty they are. You can't even make them in the US because we've made it. We basically said this stuff is so nasty. It's so dirty that we're not even going to let it happen here. So you're basically taking all that nasty stuff and you're making it happen over in China. So we don't have to see it. We can just see this solar panel that shows up on a truck and we plug it in, or this windmill that goes up, and all that dirty stuff and all the carbon that's been expended and all the mining, it happens somewhere else where people can LARP about how green it is. And then sure, over time, if you do use that and the assumptions pan out that the windmill is operational for 20 years and the solar panel lasts for this long, this many decades, then yes, maybe it can offset the carbon that it took at the beginning. But basically all these supply chains, the supply chains for renewables are way more complex than the supply chains for traditional resources. I mean, it's mostly just like steel. There's not that much that we need to drill a well versus these renewable industries. It's just a really complex supply chain and you're effectively, it's not completely domestically sourced. Like we can't, like if we got in a war with China and they cut off the, you know, the ability to get the raw materials for solar panels, like the prices of solar panels would skyrocket. No one would put solar panels in anymore. Like you're basically just relying on China to provide this stuff to you. So that's my rant on on that stuff.
I got to clip that. That's very good. Very strong. Like I said to you before the show, I don't want to keep it too much longer than 40 minutes. So let's do maybe one or two more questions. Then I got a question unrelated to energy, Bitcoin, all that stuff. Your expertise, honestly, Max, outstanding answers so far. And a lot of this stuff is stuff that people are concerned about but don't really have any place to go. And I think one of the things people are asking is, you know, what should governments be doing? You know, what should they be doing that they're not doing now? Obviously, you know, maybe loosening restrictions or whatever is one piece. But, you know, if they put Max Gagliardi in the White House tomorrow, okay, let's say you're in there. We got Max, he's thinking about energy policy. He's thinking about a five-year strategy for the United States. What are the three things that are sort of top of mind for you as far as energy independence and I guess reducing friction more than anything else? What do you think?
Yeah, so if I want to be fair, the government is going to focus right now. Their main focus is on lowering CO2. So I will spin some of that into this too, even though I think there's other things that are just as important or more important. I'm not somebody that believes that CO2 isn't a problem at all. I just think that it's a problem that can be solved through the capital markets like we've done in the US. We've lowered our CO2 output quite a bit. It's been in free fall actually since the shale revolution. We're emitting less CO2. A lot of people blame it on the offshoring, the manufacturing. It's not that. It's the switching to natural gas from coal. And the primary reason we did that is because we had so much natural gas. Yes, there was coal regulations that hurt them, but more than anything, we just have an ocean, hundreds, if not thousands of years of gas. And so it made sense. The free market solved that. And guess what? CO2 emissions plunged. It wasn't the government. It was like, we just got better at producing energy and it gets cleaner over time. That's what happens in developed worlds. I don't know where you're at, but where I'm at, I look around, there's not a lot of smog. It's not dirty here, right? Like the government didn't mandate us to make it cleaner. We just made it cleaner because we got rich and rich people don't like dirty stuff. So we eventually get cleaner over time. So the way to reduce CO2, in my opinion, is to have more abundant energy and focus on things that work like natural gas or nuclear, which nuclear is probably where the world's going to go long term. I think it'll all be at the quantum level, whether it be nuclear energy or quantum computing. Eventually, we get really good at efficiencies. And so that's probably where things will be in the long term future. In the near term future, I think it is it's infrastructure. Like if you just look at the money, and I don't want to say that I don't want to get into like the politics of sending money to Ukraine. I'm not a geopolitical expert. I have my opinions on that situation. But if you just look like at the money that we sent just for the Ukraine war alone, and we spent that money on natural gas pipelines, LNG export facilities, and new nuclear facilities, we could have done a lot with that. If you look at the money that we spent on this recent bill, this inflation reduction bill, we're building a bunch of like electric car charging stations. No one charges their car. People charge their electric cars at home. Like if you have an electric car, you plug it into your house. No one's going on road trips with these things. That's not even what they're for. This is a giant money laundering deal where they just have special interest groups that want to get a bunch of money, and they're bringing in a bunch of subsidies and tax credits for these people that got them elected. That's all that is. It's not going to reduce CO2, and it's not going to reduce inflation. It's going to probably do the opposite. So if we wanted to reduce CO2, we'd build more natural gas pipelines. We'd build more LNG export facilities. We'd build more nuclear plants. And we could do that for, what was it, like $300 billion or something? I mean, if you said $300 billion and you took that and you said, we're going to use this to finance nuclear facilities, and it's all going to be government-backed debt to where you can't default on it. And by the way, you got to get the plant built in 4 years, not 10, or you're not going to get your money. Go. And they said, do that. You could, 30% down on these facilities, people could lever up. You could build $1 trillion with the nukes. That would probably be like something like, I had a guess on it, said that'd be like 20%+ additional to our to lowering our power mix, and would lower emissions just dramatically. They're never going to do that because that doesn't give their constituents that got them elected a bunch of money. And so it's not going to happen, but that's what I'd probably do. I would invest in infrastructure. I would build out more natural gas pipelines out of the Northeast. We're really constrained right now in the Northeast United States. It's hard to get new nat gas out of there. A bunch of pipelines have been blocked by environmentalists. They said they're going to do it in this new bill. I don't think it's actually going to happen. We'll see. That would be deflationary because it would unlock new supply, which would mean the price would go down. I have a buddy who's like a hardcore Democrat, and he's always like, you should like Democrats being in. The oil and gas industry always does good because prices go up. And it's like, yeah, I get your point. But we also, as the industry, just like having certainty. Like you mentioned it earlier, like knowing what the regulatory environment's going to be. And there's times when the government's done it. Like back in World War II, there was this project called the Big Inch and the Little Inch. It was this gigantic, like 1,700-mile long oil pipeline that they built from Texas to New Jersey, two pipelines. And they did it in like rapid speed. And it's one of the most private and public projects that's ever been done. Like one of the largest projects ever where private business and government worked together. And they built this giant oil pipeline because the German U-boats were blowing up our oil tankers in the Gulf of Mexico and going over to Europe. And so they were like, we got to have a better route. So they built infrastructure. And what it did was it made our manufacturing base, and it lowered the price, and it got us to be able to make all these things that we did to win the war. So there's like, if the government wanted to, we could do a lot of things that would dramatically reduce inflation. And that's called bringing on supply. I think the whole thing right now, even with the Fed, like raising rates, it's like this is a supply driven. Yes, they printed too much money. And yes, people got a bunch of checks airdropped into their bank account and went and bought CDs, and price of CDs went way up or whatever. But like for the most part, we just need more, we need more supply. And so raising rates doesn't, you can print money, you can't print energy, and they just need to give ways to increase supply. And unfortunately, the stuff that they just did in this recent bill isn't going to help inflation. It's raising rates isn't going to help supply. Raising rates hurts companies. Like when rates go up, it makes it harder to drill for new oil and gas because they have less access to credit. So that's my rant on that. I think I would just basically build new infrastructure and incentivize supply. And by the way, that would also hurt Russia more than any of this other shit that they're doing right now. Because if you want to hurt Putin, make the price of oil go back to $40 and make the price of gas go back to $250, and he's done. Like he's not gonna be able to finance any of this war. So if they were smart, they'd be bringing on new supply and building infrastructure we actually need.
I'll be happy to buy a t-shirt from your presidential campaign when those are ready. So, okay, last question here on oil, gas, and then I got one fun one for you before you get lost. On Talk Energy, you got a lot of great guests, and I got to be honest, I have barely heard of any of them before they come on your show. And that tells me that I'm missing a lot of good content out there on Twitter. So who's one person, Twitter, YouTube, podcast, that, you know, apart from you, people should be paying a little more attention to, giving a little more time to?
I think like a guy that I really like is Brian Gitt. I've had him on a number of times. He's kind of blown up now. He has got a bunch of followers now. He does a good job at really taking the facts around renewables. And he pulls a lot of his stuff from like Schellenberger, Michael Schellenberger, who a lot of you probably know and follow. So he's got kind of a similar angle as Michael Schellenberger, where it's like very facts driven. He's also got a lot of stuff from like Alex Epstein and people. And he's done a good job of just kind of combining it and not really putting the emotion in. You know, like for me, it's like, yeah, I could look up all these facts, or I could just make a funny meme and that'd be way easier and just post that. But Brian does a great job of like actually, you know, researching these topics and putting it out there. And then some of the other guests that I've really enjoyed that I didn't know about, some of the people in the coal space, I think the coal world, coal is really interesting. So Matt Warder is a guy that I like. And then on the US policy side, like Mike Umbro is great. He does a lot of stuff around all the LARPing in California and all the NIMBYism where they're saying not in my backyard and pushing it out to other countries, which is actually way dirtier. He's been a great guest. You know, Doomberg's blown up now. I mean, when I first had him on, he only had like 20,000 followers. Now he's like a jillion followers, but I would say everybody knows who he is now. Those are just people right off the top of my head. I'm sure I'm missing a lot of people, but it's just fun. It's like hard to find. That's the thing about getting guests for the podcast, and you probably know the struggle. It's like, it gets hard. Like if you're doing, I was doing them like 2 weeks there for a while. And I just had like one for a while. It was kind of like a standing show that I had that was more like recaps. But then I started doing like two guests a week. It's just hard to like find enough people that want to come and talk. I mean, just the scheduling and all that stuff is really brutal. So, I'm always out there looking for better guests, or not better, but just good guests. And I try to pull from people I know. I call them like real world people and Twitter people. There's some of people are both, and those are some of the best guests. But I try to pull some real world people in too that may not be on Twitter. Two more that I just thought of. So Mark Mills is a really popular. He kind of debunks a lot of this renewable stuff. Sorry, I'm getting a call here. Let me shut that off.
Busy man.
he's like a guy that debunks a lot of the renewable stuff, and he's a pro oil and gas advocate. I've got an episode coming out with him next week. Another episode that I did, Scott Tinker, who is an absolutely OG oil and gas advocate. He's not really like oil and gas advocate per se. He's more just like an energy guy. He's a geologist. He's like the head of, he's a professor, I believe, at the University of Texas, but that's another great episode. Just some, these guys are kind of OGs. They're older and they just have a ton of wisdom. So those are two that I would check out. I don't think Scott's on Twitter, but he's on LinkedIn, and Mark Mills is on Twitter. And his stuff is great. So it's two people you can check out.
Getting one comment here in the chat. Git was on another Canadian show, the Money Talk Show, whose host will actually be on this show, I think, in a few weeks. So I'm looking forward. I got to check that out. Okay, Max, you've been a great guest. Last question. You're an Oklahoman. Are you a basketball fan?
Yeah, man. I mean, the Oklahoma City Thunder, it's been a little bit rough the last couple of years. I mean, not gonna lie, I haven't watched as much. I don't want to say a fair weather, but I watched it a little bit now. There for a while, we went on that run and like the Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and that whole saga was pretty amazing. We got robbed in the finals that year. They just such BS calls for LeBron. And just the whole narrative was messed up, right? It was like, they were like, LeBron's the underdog. You guys are ranked higher. I was like, no, he's not. They were like 22. And they were saying that like LeBron was the underdog and Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade. And it was like all the calls went to them. It's just such a rigged system. It was like every game, just them getting every call. I'm just still sour about it. But it was an amazing team. We had some great, great runs, some really good Western Conference finals. And the team right now, it's like they've got a lot of exciting young guys. The guy we drafted this year got hurt like immediately in like our preseason game. That was pretty brutal. So I haven't been following as much lately. Part of it too is like just sports in general. Now that I've gotten older and have kids, it's like hard to get as emotionally invested as I used to get like in my early 20s and mid 20s as I can now that I've got like three children. It's a little harder.
On this show, I'm often seen wearing a Westbrook OKC jersey. I'm a Russell Westbrook maximalist. Your thoughts on Westbrook? Where is this guy in your pantheon? Is he top 50? Is he top 30? Where is he? Where do you put him?
He's an absolute freak, dude. Westbrook is amazing. He he just is one of these guys. Like the triple double thing is, you know, people, it got like to the point where people were just like, oh, whatever, you got another triple double. Like it was ridiculous. I mean, the guy did everything. He's got like some things that, like, you know, people will dig on him for. It's like, oh, he should have done this, he should have done that. But there's like no guy that plays harder than Russell Westbrook, especially like in his prime at Oklahoma City. Just a pleasure to, like, just really like fortunate to have him. Kevin Durant's kind of a bitch because he left when he did, even though whatever, people do what they do. The way he did it was really lame. But when KD and Westbrook were here, that duo was pretty incredible. I think they could have won a final if Kevin would have stayed. But Russell's just a great guy. Like, he did the city really good, and he stuck with us, and he was idolized here. And then whenever he left really gracefully. He signed a new deal that was like, it was like the highest paid deal ever. So it wasn't like he was like, oh, I'm taking a bullet, making the most money ever. But the fact that he did that, and then that allowed us to trade him, which we got a really good value back for, and actually had a couple more years where it was really fun with like Carmelo Anthony and Chris Paul and some of those guys. We had, you know, a few other fun seasons, which he didn't have to do. He could have just left. So I think he's a class act. I think he's a Oklahoma legend. He's going to be in the Oklahoma Hall of Fame. If he's not already, he might already be in it. So he's a great guy. He's really fun to watch.
You can come back anytime after that last comment. Okay, Max, tell people where they can find you. Twitter, your podcast, floor is all yours, man.
Yeah, it's just Max underscore Gagliardi on Twitter. And the podcast is Talk Energy Podcast. The Twitter that I have for it, I just kind of retweet the episodes. So it's a good place to find all the episodes because I typically try to retweet those on there and have them all on there, do some clips. We have a Substack. It's Ancova Energy. It comes out once a week. We talk about just like updates on oil and gas pricing. And sometimes I'll rant on there, just like on my, I'll write like something about whatever's going on in the markets. And then that's pretty much it. The YouTube channel too. But I'm around mainly on Twitter, shit posting memes. So if you want to check it out, come by.
Outstanding. Thanks for your time, brother. Take care, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
All right. Thanks, Joey.
Well done, sir. Way to go.
Thanks, man.